last time a little bit. I'll touch upon it again about Alan Greenspan's comments on gold. And it's rather revealing that he wrote this. He used to be something of a libertarian and a follower of Ayn Rand, who wrote many books kind of explaining some of the economics of the times in her vast repertoire of novels and such. But in the book Capitalism, he wrote a little prelogue to it. And he was explaining how an honest monetary system and freedom are inseparable. And he was promoting a gold standard at that time because when you look in the history of gold and how it's related to freedom, basically gold puts a capitation upon the size, power, and scope of government. If you have the government with this, as I say, unlimited access to printing press money, they're not checked. But with gold, it's a fixed amount. And if there's only so much gold floating around and you want to go to war and spend a lot of money, there's problems there. Because there's the people have the gold, and if the government wants to do things, it has to go to the people. Again, of, by, and for the people. And so he talked quite a bit about the necessity of checking the government. And he says the welfare, and I'll say slash warfare state, is nothing more than a mechanism by which governments confiscate the wealth of citizens to support a wide variety of all their different schemes. And under a gold standard, the government deficit spending would be severely limited. So people who promote unlimited, all-powerful government are very much in favor of a paper currency. And he says, this is the shabby secret of the welfare warfare status tirade against gold. Deficit spending is simply a scheme for the hidden confiscation of wealth. Gold stands in the way of this insidious process. It stands as a protector of property rights. If one grasps this, then one has no difficulty in understanding the status antagonism towards the gold standard. Now, one of the questions I remember asking Ed Griffin when he was being interviewed here by Dr. Monteith, I asked him, I said, you know, the Federal Reserve System has been around since 1913, and you look at how wealthy the country was in 1913, and look what we have now, all these freeways and cars and everything. It's not a totally unfunctional system. And he talked about, yes, that's true, but when you look, what it was really ended up doing is distorting where the money has gone. And where has so much of the money gone is towards the, all these unnecessary wars. You know, every war in the 20th century would be totally unavoidable. I mean, they were totally unnecessary to have these wars. You go into the history of how they came about. They're all wrought by the power elite of all these different countries. They had their own agenda, but all these wars weren't anything that any of the people in the country, these different countries, really wanted. The people were manipulated into these wars by the money powers in each of their respective countries. A great article, too, by Ron Paul. He's got out in front of Congress and had quite a speech on the Federal Reserve System. In fact, his whole point, it can be summed up in the title of his speech, Paper Money and Tyranny. And he was explaining very carefully how this unlimited access by the federal government to all the money it could ever possibly want is the royal road to tyranny. And that is the road that we're on. And so it's absolutely crucial. If you really want to put a check on this unlimited warfare that the federal government is engaged in, you've got to do something about taking away the source of their power. We live in a society where money is a reality of life, and I think most people realize money really determines a lot of their lifestyle, how they live, and so forth. And it's also true nationally. And most of our dollars, as I say, the tax dollars, are going into the federal government. And what are you getting out of that federal government? Well, I'm going to wind down here a little bit early, and I will join you again next Monday night at 7 o'clock. Thank you very much for listening.
Good evening, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily the views of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us this evening again Deborah Ray. We're going to be talking more about her book, The ABCs of Globalism. We've talked about it in the past. And, of course, she arranges in alphabetical order most of the major issues that you need to know about as you're addressing the problems of our time. And we had her on, and we got up to about D. So we're going to, of course, pick up and go through the rest of her book. Now, we carry the book. We think it's an important book. You would certainly benefit from having this at hand. And, I'm sorry. We've got Ron Brown on the line here. Is that Ron Brown?
Yes, it sure is.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, Ron, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, glad to be with you, Stan.
All right, fine. Well, we were going to have Deborah tomorrow night, so give us. We're going to be talking tonight a little bit about what's happening financially here. We see, you know, our attention is focused on what's going on in the Middle East, and of course, we're concerned about the war. Did they know about the weapons of mass destruction beforehand? Did the president intentionally mislead the public? Was he misled by the intelligence agencies? But while our attention is focused on the casualties there, we very seldom talk about the almost 12,000 American casualties, besides the 550 now that have been killed in Iraq, or the 400 that have been killed in Afghanistan. But while our attention is focused overseas, why we're really losing our freedom here at home as we transfer our jobs, we transfer our factories overseas, and of course there is an organized effort to destroy the value of the American dollar. In fact, on 60 Minutes last night, I watch this every Sunday evening because I want to know what the enemy is doing, and they actually after they had the first interview. They had, just for no reason at all, suddenly a man appeared, and he was talking about the economy. It had nothing to do with anything. It was just on for about 30 seconds. And it said they intend to allow the dollar, the American dollar, to decrease even further. And we know it's already down almost 40% against European currency over the last several years. So, Ron, why don't you tell our listeners what's going on economically and what your thoughts are on where we stand, what's going to happen to our economy?
Well, of course, I guess the best place to start is just to understand the nature of our money and what's happened to it over the years. And, of course, our nation was formed with a gold-backed dollar, which means every dollar had to be backed by a specific amount of gold, which in turn puts a limitation on how many of those dollars it can be printed, which maintains their value. And for the first 124 years of our nation, after the Constitution was passed in 1791, the value of the dollar maintained 100% of its value for 124 years. And of course, since then, the dollar has lost probably 95, 96, 97% of its value as we print more and more of these bogus dollars. But the real problem is that our money isn't just fiat, it's debt money. So as they create this money, they're really creating more and more debt that has to be serviced. And as that debt gets larger and larger and larger, the burden, or the interest burden, becomes unsustainable, and that's the point we're at now. So the dollar is in the process of trying, or let me put it another way, the laws of economics are in the process of trying to unload that debt structure, and of course the powers to be, the people in charge, are trying to print money faster than the markets can destroy it, and that's why we're going into this massive spending binge, because our monetary system really, bottom line, has become nothing more than a confidence game, or better put, it's a Ponzi scheme in the sense that they must not allow the system to ever contract. It must continue to grow. And that's why they have to keep the printed press running faster and faster.
But, Ron, the problem is that this was all well and good when America did have gold behind its currency. This was all well and good when America was the engine of industrial production throughout the world. And although we are still a major producer, we're producing less and less every year as our jobs are transferred, as our industries are transferred overseas. And, of course, we are really dependent today on other countries, other central banks, buying our debt just to keep us going. In fact, it said that if the other countries stopped buying our debt, why the whole system, economic system of the entire world would collapse. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's absolutely true. And they have been financing our debt for the last 20, 30, 40 years. The key, though, is that they're in the same lifeboat with us, in the sense that they need to trade with us desperately, especially Japan, and of course China has pegged the yuan to the dollar, so they're doing that. If the dollar goes lower, then they trade more throughout the world, so they're going to go along with it for a while. But also their problem is that over the last 30, 40 years, foreigners on average have invested 70% of their reserves in dollar investments. So it's a two-edged sword. As the dollar drops, then their investments go down the tubes. And so the question is, they want out of dollars, but they can't just cash out. So Japan in particular, I'm glad you mentioned this, because last month alone, Japan bought $76 billion to keep the dollar propped up against the yen, so they could continue their trade with us, because they're an export nation. So you see, Japan's really between a rock and a hard place.
Well, one of the interesting things is that with the decline in the value of the American dollar, the Saudis, every time they sell a barrel of oil, a barrel of oil, are losing 30% of what they should be getting. And hang on to that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Ron Brown. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Ron Brown. And we're going to be talking about the economy, and certainly we'll welcome your calls at 888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But the Saudis are very unhappy because, of course, they actually sell their oil for dollars, at least they have traditionally in the past. Now, my understanding, though, is that the Saudis are beginning to move away a little bit from the United States. They've signed some very important contracts with the Russians to develop some of their natural gas fields. They've signed contracts with the Chinese. Up until now, of course, America was the one who exploited most of the Saudi oil and natural gas fields. And suddenly, Russia then is beginning to look to our traditional enemies or our adversaries for support. And, of course, it's assumed that some of that trade with Russia will be in gold rather than in dollars. I think that the big fear is, what happens if the world starts moving towards trade with the gold dinar, which, of course, is being advocated by the Muslim countries and certainly by Saudi Arabia? What happens if the trade increasingly comes to be denominated in euros rather than dollars? Then what happens to the reserve status of the American dollar? And if we're already down 40%, and according to our good friend Joan Vian, who's been attending these international conferences and will be with us later this week, she claims that the plan is to let it go down another 30%. Now, to the average American, this doesn't really mean anything because, of course, they're not buying a lot of things from Europe, and the things coming into China are about the same price because the Chinese yuan is tied to our currency. But what happens if China breaks with our currency and begins to raise its prices? What's going to happen to the purchasing power of the average American if our dollar's down 70%?
Yeah, the other shoe is going to drop at some point. This whole process is going to take years to unravel. As the world, one, tries to get out of dollars, they have to do it very gradually. So I don't think there's any doubt that the dollar is being slowly repudiated as the world's reserve currency, which means oil will no longer be priced in dollars. It will be priced in some combination of euros and dinars, as you mentioned. And so as we're discarded as the world's reserve currency, the privileges we've had as of being the world's reserve currency are going to get taken away from us. And the privilege has been that the whole world was willing to finance our folly because they stored their reserves in dollars because all trade was determined in dollars. And so as we lose that status, then all of a sudden, this massive debt structure that we have built up over the last 100 years is going to come right back in our laps, and of course at a time when we're least prepared to deal with them. What's our debt? We've talked about it many times. They admit to $7.5 trillion, but as you know, with all the programs, the debt's probably closer to $40 trillion. So,
well, now you're talking about the money that we have committed to give to our citizens in the form of Social Security payments, and there is no Social Security fund other than debt, and of course then all the money that we're committed to give in the form of Medicare, and there is no Medicare fund, and that's all been spent in years past so the politicians could live high on the hog and so we could live high on the hog. In other words, what we've been doing is living on our children and our grandchildren's legacy, and that money is all spent. And when the baby boomers begin retiring later this decade, why, it's not going to take more than about 5 years or so, and this whole thing's going to begin to implode, and they know that. But right now, I think they have one thing in mind, and that is get us through November of this year. Don't let things fall apart before then, because they don't want the American people to really stop and think of the implications of what's going on, and maybe to say, we're not going to play this game anymore. We're not going to vote for the Skull and Bones candidate, John Kerry, who's running against Skull and Bones candidate George W. Bush. Certainly, John Kerry is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a continuation of that secret society that Cecil Rhodes created to bring about a world government. And although George W. Bush is not a member, all the people who surround him are, certainly Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, they all come from the Council on Foreign Relations. And the President's father, George Herbert Walker Bush, was a member, longtime member of the Board of Directors of the Council on Foreign Relations. He only resigned just before he ran for the presidency back in 1980. But certainly George Herbert Walker Bush was part of the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission. He was the director of the CIA and longtime member of the Council on Foreign Relations. So I think that they're going to do everything they can to keep the economy going this year. What about this idea that they are artificially stimulating the stock market? In other words, if it weren't that they were coming in with what they call a plunge protection team, why this stock market would be nowhere near what it is today. Do you think there's any truth to that charge?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about it. They've been propping up the stock market, and they've been suppressing the price of gold and silver for the last 20 years at least. And of course, as things get worse, they have to spend faster and faster to keep it from collapsing. To give you an idea, in the silver market, just as an example, last week in the futures market, we're talking about on the COMEX, these commercial bankers, there's about eight of them that in my opinion are nothing more than surrogates of the central banks, and that would be the Goldman Sachs's and the Morgan Chase's and the Deutsche Banks and so forth. But in 5 days, these eight or less traders sold 52 million ounces of paper silver on the COMEX.
But it's silver they didn't actually own. They just sold it with the idea of driving the price down. Isn't that how the game is played?
Absolutely, because the price of all commodities is a function of the futures market. When someone asks you what's the spot price, well, the spot price by definition is the nearby month on the futures market.
But isn't this really dishonest to join together in some sort of a coordinated effort to manipulate the markets, the commodity markets?
Well, it violates every standard rule on the commodity markets. But apparently the powers to be are so desperate that the people that are supposed to be controlling it are keeping very quiet about it and doing nothing to stop it.
All right. So one of the things we've talked about in the past was the fact that there is a world shortage of silver. Now, I've been following this from other sources, and it was anticipated that certainly by the middle of this year, why they would have run out of silver. In other words, the demand for silver was greater than the amount of silver that is available, and you'd be in one of those traditional squeeze plays where the price would have to go up to begin bringing in junk silver, other sources of silver, silverware, certainly silver, various things that people had. When the price gets high enough, why they're willing to part with them. Where do we really stand as far as the world supplies of silver compared with the amount that is being utilized on a monthly basis?
Well, every month about 10 million ounces of silver basically evaporates. It's consumed in the industrial process.
Now that would be what, photography, various types of electronics, things of that sort?
Yeah, the weather, it's used in literally thousands and thousands of industrial applications. And usually, each application uses so little of it. For example, the batteries on your watch and electrical points and so forth. There's so little silver used that once you make that product, you never bother to recycle it. So that silver is never brought back in. Now, silver in photography is a little different story. Probably 70-80% of that silver, I don't know the exact percentage, but a large percentage of that silver is actually recycled. But the world continues to consume 100 to 150 million ounces more silver each year than it produces. And so it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that if you do that year after year after year, and we've been doing it for 35 out of the last 40 years, that glut of silver that was out there from 1964 or 65 when we demonetized silver has now been consumed and it's gone. We've been, in effect, consuming our seed coin for the last 40 years, and now we're literally down to the dredges in the bottom of the barrel.
Well, now, of course, the significant thing is that the silver mines really aren't mining very much silver because there's no profit to be made at the relatively low prices that it is. It used to be that we had a lot of silver mines mining a lot of silver because the government would always buy it, but that's really no longer true. In other words, that they can't really make any money mining silver at the current rates, can they?
No, very few of them can. Most of the mines have been shut down for 10, 15 years. And it's just a perfect illustration of what happens when man interferes with the laws of nature. See, the laws of supply and demand in economics would bring it back into balance except the politicians who are trying to maintain this bogus monetary system must suppress the price of gold and silver, because gold and silver, in effect, act as a barometer of confidence in the paper money. So if gold is rising or silver is rising, it's spreading alarm throughout the world that the monetary system is in trouble, so then people panic out of the paper money.
Well, I think the interesting thing is, as long as the central banks own all the gold, as long as there's not adequate gold out there to use it for currency, then what are people going to use as a medium of exchange? Why, you've got to use the central bankers' paper currency, which they can create absolutely out of nothing, having nothing relationship to anything. And then, of course, their favorite people can go around and buy up the media, which they've done, buy up industries, which they've done, buy up the drug companies, which they've done, buy up the politicians, which they've done so successfully. In fact, here in America today, it's said that we have the finest politicians that money can buy. And, of course, as you know, the president is going into this election cycle. He's got well over $150 million already to spend. But then don't worry about John Kerry. His wife is a multi, she has $500 million of her own, and then a foundation with another $1 billion. So John Kerry is certainly not really worried. They're both from the elite group that believe that an elite should rule. And really, whether the Democrats or the Republicans win, why we lose. We'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest Ron Brown, and of course invite your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Ron Brown, and we've just been talking more or less about what's happening to the economy, and, of course, right now we're on the subject of silver. And so what do you anticipate, Ron? Do you think that the silver squeeze will come here in the next few months, or will it be later this year or next year or the year after that? Or do we have any way of really knowing what's going on?
I really believe we're getting very, very close to it. If you just watch the silver action just the last 3 to 6 months, it's becoming more and more obvious that the people who have controlled the price in the past are losing control. Before they could keep the price below $4 to $5, they would bust it down at will, and when they would bust it down, it would take 3 to 6 months for the market to ever recover back to where it was. Well, last week they put out all the stops. These bankers are now short 400 to 450 million ounces of silver that doesn't exist. And they worked hard to drive the price down, and they had it down 40 cents in one day. And in the last 3-4 days, it's recovered all of that and gone positive from where it was. So they're totally losing their ability to control it. Now, there is a very interesting article for those who are on the Internet. Go to gold-eagle.com. And there's an article by, it's called GATA on Gold. And GATA, of course, is the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, and that is the group of brilliant people who have followed and tracked and showed the manipulation of the gold market. Now they're jumping on the silver market.
Now, are these the ones that are actually suing the Federal Reserve, and is this tied into Blanchard's lawsuit against the bankers who are conspiring to manipulate the currency markets?
GATA brought the first lawsuit 2 years ago, 3 years ago. It was thrown out of court, not because it was not valid. They said the people issuing the lawsuit didn't have any standing in the court, so therefore they couldn't make a claim or a lawsuit. But it's the same people or the same information that's being used that Blanchard's using.
All right, fine. So what does this GATA article tell us?
Well, it's about a 14-page article, and it really has information, because GATA has members from all over the world. And so it had some knowledgeable people from all over the world sharing information with them. The one that really caught my attention is that there was a group of investors in Europe that had invested heavily in gold at 325, and their plan was to sell their gold at 375 or 380, but the gold became so strong, what they decided to do was switch their gold into silver. And so just a few months back, they were trying to buy 40 million ounces of silver, and they couldn't find 40 million ounces of silver all over the globe, so they ended up buying a lot of that position, as the article said, in the futures market. So you have these growing open interest in the futures market, and for people who don't know what the futures market is, it's really like a bookie operation where you have people betting on silver to go up and people betting on silver to go down, and for every buyer there has to be a seller. So the buyer, when he buys a contract, has the option, if he chooses, to demand delivery, and each contract is 5,000 ounces. If he demands delivery, then the person on the other side, someone has to deliver that silver to him. And so here we have these bankers who are short.
Hold that thought right there, Ron. We'll be right back. Okay, our guest this evening is Ron Brown, and Ron is one of the supporters of Radio Liberty, and he's in the gold and silver business. And so he was talking about the fact that over in Europe there was a group of investors who wanted to pick up something like 40 million ounces of silver, and there wasn't 40 million ounces of silver. In other words, there isn't that amount of silver that you can actually lay your hands on, so people are going into the silver futures market, which is all paper silver. In other words, it's a promise that they're going to provide it, and you may very well be able to profit from that. But let me just suggest one thing. I'm old enough to know a little bit about the commodity market, and the commodity market is a wonderful way to make a small fortune out of a large fortune. Do not go into the commodity market. Don't even think about it in your wildest dreams. This is something that is not for the average individual to be in at all. Unless you know exactly what you're doing and a position to buy the product outright, you should not be having anything to do with the commodity market, and don't let anybody ever talk you into it. Would you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree. 95% of the people lose, and especially now in the silver market, when the people that are short and vulnerable to get really hurt bad are these bankers who are the surrogates of the central banks and the people who make the rules.
And, of course, they just change the rules. If we get into a squeeze position, they'll do what they did to Bunker Hunt back in the 1980s, and they just changed all the rules of the market and destroyed the fortune of this great fortune of Bunker Hunt and his brother.
Who happened to be a real patriot to America. So, they went out to get him, and they wiped him out and took him out of the picture. So what will happen is when silver breaks out of their control, and by the way, that article was talking about that it's very, very possible that a squeeze in the market is coming by May. And so if that happens, then silver could literally explode as it's done in the past.
All right, so it's really more or less speculation as to when it's going to happen. The only thing that everybody seems to agree on is it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. And of course, the same thing is really true with gold. Isn't there an increasing purchase of gold by China, by India, these other countries that are prospering so very much, and they're trying to get something behind their currency because they've lost confidence in the paper money system?
Absolutely. You know, they all would like to get out of dollars, but they can't. So what they're doing is squirreling away a little gold as they can, and they're just taking it off the market. For the last 6, 7, 8, maybe 10 years, the gold demand has been something like 1,700 to 2,000 tons greater than world production. So the central banks have been dumping the gold gradually to meet that demand to keep the price from exploding to the upside. And then they used every other means they could to manipulate the price and hold the price down.
Well, now, of course, we're being told that the euro, this currency put out by the European Common Market, has a 15% gold backing, whereas, of course, the American dollar has absolutely no gold backing. In fact, there's a serious question whether they've actually sold most of our gold. But is it really true that the euro does have a 15% gold backing?
You know, to me, talk is cheap. If you have a gold-backed currency, the only way that makes any sense to me is if it's interchangeable. In other words, back when we were gold-backed, people carried around gold certificates, which basically said on the bill, this certifies there has been deposited in the Treasury of the United States of America $10 or $20 in gold coin payable to bearer on demand. So you could take that piece of paper and exchange it for the gold. Now, to come out and say it's backed by gold, but you have no no way of exchanging that paper for gold, what does the gold backing really mean? I don't know if they have 15% backing it or not. It's really nothing more than a fiat paper currency trying to use gold to give it credibility.
You know, I think it's so interesting, as I've seen the evolution of this, and I, because I'm old enough to remember gold-backed currency, you know, at that time the paper was, you had your gold certificates, and then when the gold was taken out, why, the Federal Reserve note said, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, and is redeemable in lawful money at any branch of the United States Treasury or the Federal Reserve system.
Which was redeemable in more of the paper.
But then one day, suddenly they even changed that. And they said, without any fanfare, that little note on the bill, on the currency, said, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, period. In other words, there is no more any lawful currency at all. We are on a total fiat money system. This was back in the 1960s. And while our attention was focused on what was going on in Vietnam, why, of course, we lost our monetary stability here at home. In a similar manner, now that our attention is focused on what's going on over in Iraq, why, we're not really watching what's happening here, as our industries, our jobs, and our the value of our currency is being gradually destroyed. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment or two with Ron Brown. And when we get back, we'd love to have your calls here at Radio Liberty, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Ron Brown. And one, we bring our listeners back, why, we'll tell you how to get hold of Ron. But right now, we're simply talking about what's happening as far as gold and silver are concerned, because we find that the other countries of the world really don't want to go along with this fiat money system any longer. After all, we just print money, created out of nothing. We buy their goods, and that's good for their economy. But they end up then with worthless dollars, which the only thing they can do is reinvest them in our bonds, and our bonds are not paying a very good interest rate. In fact, our currency is dropping in value faster than the, or to a greater degree than the interest they're getting in return. So as they invest their money in our currency, it continues to decrease in value. Certainly aren't these people rather unhappy that they've invested in our bonds and those bonds have decreased somewhere between 30% and 40% in the last couple of years?
Absolutely. You know, the whole world is becoming unhappy with us for many different reasons. The whole Middle East is unfortunately, we're in way over our head there, because we're trying to straighten out what has been turmoil for throughout history, and I don't think we're going to come in and make those people suddenly get together and get along after all these years. So we're in over our head there. We're spending money at no end in sight. So the world is trying to get out of those dollars, just as they got out of the British sovereign or the British money back in the early 1900s.
I think the Americans had forgotten that, you know, up until, I guess it was, what, about the Second World War, the British pound sterling was really the dominant currency, means of exchange, certainly through the First World War anyway. And when did the dollar become the major currency of the world?
Right after World War II, right as the war was ending, the monetary authorities throughout the world got together in Bretton Woods, the Connecticut, or New...
Right close to Washington, D.C., somewhere in there.
Right. And that was in 1944, and that's when they created the Bretton Woods Agreement, where, in effect, the dollar was made the reserve currency, and all the other currencies of the world were pegged to the dollar.
But, of course, then, at that time, all the other countries in the world could exchange dollars for gold.
Exactly. That was the crux of the system. And, of course, our representatives at the Bretton Woods Agreement were both later tried and convicted as communists. So
you're talking about Harry Dexter White and
right.
Are you talking about Morgenthau? Or,
I can't even remember who the other one was.
The other major person was John Maynard Keynes, and I don't think he was certainly a dedicated Fabian socialist.
Right, but he was British.
He was. So. We'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I think you're probably talking about Alger Hiss. Was Alger Hiss?
Alger Hiss.
Right.
That's right.
And Harry Dexter White, actually, I think, died before he could be... he died rather mysteriously after he was charged with being a communist agent, which he was. And, we, of course, that all came out in the Verona files. So the two people who really put this thing together were communists, and their goal was the destruction of the United States.
Absolutely.
Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. If you have a question or comment, you agree or disagree with what we're talking about. But I will tell you that if you don't make your preparations now to protect yourself, there are going to be serious consequences either this year or certainly by this time next year. Would you agree with that, Ron?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, when people typically look at gold and silver or any type of investment, and if it's not something they're comfortable with, they say, well, I'll just have to miss out on this investment. Gold and silver really is not about an investment now. It's about financial survival, because every other investment that people feel comfortable with, whether it's their stocks or their bonds or their CDs or their checking account or the real estate market, basically is all investments that are denominated in dollars. And if the dollar is what's being destroyed, then what is going to happen to all those investments that people feel comfortable with? And so it's really imperative that people open their eyes and understand what's really happening, that a monetary system that we call the dollar, that has been in existence for 90 years, it's a fiat-based system, is now collapsing the way of all fiat systems throughout the history of the world. There has never been an exception. And I think we're in the last stages of this dollar. And, of course, there's an agenda behind it. The people that are doing it have plans to merge us into a one-world currency. And, of course, at that point, our nation has lost its sovereignty.
And I really believe that they know exactly what they're doing. They're not stupid people. And, of course, the only way that they're going to get the American people to go along with this world currency or international currency or one world currency will be to collapse this system. And then out of the chaos it will come, will come the cry, we need a world government. And I believe that's coming. Well, we've got Ed calling from Aptos. Ed, did you have a question for our guest?
I have a brief question, Stan. For both of you guys, you're a small hand of mouther. You have $2,000. You need $1,000 to keep on hand for emergencies. You have $1,000 to spend on gold and silver. Would you buy all gold or would you buy all silver?
All right. The $2,000, he's got to invest $1,000. Where would you put that $1,000 right now?
I would buy a quarter bag of junk silver, dimes or quarters.
Now, why do you say that? Why would you do that rather than gold?
One, I believe silver is going to outperform gold at least 5 or 6 to 1. Right now, for example, the gold-to-silver ratio, and of course, when you and I first started talking, Dr. Stan, the gold-to-silver ratio was over 80 to 1, and now it's at 63 to 1, but I believe it's going down to a minimum of 10 to 1, which means silver will go up at least 6-fold compared to whatever gold does.
All right.
Gold could quadruple, but silver is going to go up 5 or 6 times more than the gold, in my opinion.
So if gold quadruples, you would expect silver to go up 24 or 25 times.
Right.
All right. I hope that answers your question, Ed. And if you have any other questions, it's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Well, Ron, I know that you put together a report on silver. Why don't you tell our listeners how they can get a copy of that report that you made up?
Okay, my number is 1-800-595-0561. And if you'll give me a call at that number tomorrow, I'll be glad to send you a package of information that goes into what's going on with the economy and why I think silver will be the best hedge against the coming crisis.
That's 1-800-595-0561, is that right?
That's right.
All right, so let's then get on to discussing some of the other things that are happening. You know, as we look at the economy, the only parts of the economy really doing fairly well are the housing section of the economy, and the defense part of the economy. Those parts are really doing pretty well. But as you look at the statistics for what's happening with car sales aren't doing very well. Of course, Japanese car sales are doing pretty well, but GM and Ford are having some real problems. Our domestic automotive producers are having real problems as far as that's concerned. But the only people who are really doing pretty well are the drug companies. Now, of course, we've given them a guaranteed bonanza. This new Medicare bill really was sort of a stipend, a transfer of funds from the American taxpayer to the drug companies. So they're really doing pretty well. But as far as our major production is concerned, our major production is really can't very well compete with what's happening over in China because they can do it so much more cheaply than we can.
Absolutely. If people understand the dilemma that this monetary system, this whole debt-based system, this massive debt structure that we have built over the last 40, 50 years, is desperately trying to collapse, and the people in charge are desperately trying to keep it together. So the real estate bubble is one of the ways they've done it. And they have, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and Billy Bob and all these government quasi-agencies that are artificially taking the interest rates low, pumping money into the mortgage market, forcing real estate values higher. Then they turn around and say, come back in and refinance your house and pull that excess equity out and spend, baby, spend, because that's what holds this house of cards together. So the real estate market is just a bubble, and it's a way that they can create more money, but all bubbles eventually have to collapse, just as the dot-com bubble burst back in the year 2000. And this real estate bubble will be no different, because if people are losing their jobs every day, then you're not going to make your mortgage payment for loan.
And I think this is really the major concern. We even hear this actually mentioned in the controlled media. There's a concern about the fact that people are losing their jobs and we're not creating new jobs. And I thought one of the most shocking figures I'd seen was that figure that came out of the Labor Department for the month of December. And I think that people have to understand you have to create about 250,000 new jobs every month to make up for the jobs that are being lost and, of course, for the new people entering the labor market, people getting of age where they can enter the labor market and immigrants coming in, because we're certainly welcoming massive numbers of illegal immigrants to this country. This is being done intentionally and maliciously as part of a grand design to create a multicultural society. The illegal immigrant movement is being funded by the Ford Foundation. And if you doubt that, we have a wonderful book called The Importing Revolution, which everybody should read, going into how the Ford Foundation is funding the illegal immigrant movement. We have the video, The Conquest of Vast Land, goes into how the Ford Foundation is right in the middle of this whole thing. So you're going to have to create about 250,000 to 300,000 jobs a month to keep the economy moving. And in the month of December, the United States created 1,000 new jobs. I mean, that was the most frightening figure I'd seen in a long time. Did you see that, Ron?
I didn't see that one. I saw a month or so ago where the foreigners, who typically invest $50 billion a month in U.S. investments, only invested $4 billion. So, we're getting up against the edge where there's just no more rabbits to pull out of the hat to keep this thing going. So that's why I think we're so close to something big. And as you mentioned, they're going to desperately try to hold this house of cards together through the election, at least.
Because they don't want the American people to be concerned. Now, they're really not concerned whether the Democrat skull and bones candidate or the Republican skull and bones candidate wins. Because whichever one loses, their side wins. But they know that when during these election cycles, people really do begin looking and see what's going on. And of course, if they really understood that their heritage and the heritage of their children are being intentionally betrayed by the people who are dedicated to a different worldview. These people believe in a one-world government under a ruling elite. This is really what it's all about. That's what Cecil Rhodes advocated when he created his secret society to take over the world. And any of you who really question that, actually, when I went through Professor Quigley's papers back at Georgetown University in 1980, I came across Cecil Rhodes' Confession of Faith. It was written in 1875, and we'll be glad to send you a free copy of that, where he talks about creating a secret society to take over all the underdeveloped countries of the world and reunite Great Britain with the United States. So it's called Cecil Rhodes Confession of Faith. We'll be glad to send you a free copy if you'd like. Again, the number 1-800-544-8927. And of course, much of this is covered in my book, A Brotherhood of Darkness, which you really should get and should read, because it will give you the overview of the fact that there really are people out there whose loyalty is not to America, not to the preservation of this land of freedom, but to this globalist dream, a new world order, a new world religion, a ruling oligarchy. But right now they're going to do everything they can to hold the house of cards together, and certainly defense spending, they're subsidizing Boeing, finding means of, under one guise or another, giving money to Boeing, and certainly military production is doing pretty well, and they can always use the military to give a source of employment to young men who can't get a job anywhere else. But of course, do they really want to go over to Iraq to fight and bleed and suffer and die in a war that's being fought for far different reasons than the American people are told? So between the defense and housing, why those are the major parts of our industry that are doing very well. The rest of them are sort of flat. And, of course, as productivity increases, why there's less need for jobs. In other words, if you can produce more with less labor, then you're not going to be hiring new people, and those new jobs aren't being created. And one of the great miracles of our time is our productivity, I think, increased something like 9% last year, which meant, in essence, we needed almost 9% less jobs. Have you looked into that aspect of it, Ron?
Yeah, you know, you hear, of course, a lot of the talk about productivity is overstated because they use nebulous type things to, but there, you know, there's no doubt about it. If you just look at an office where you used to have someone on a typewriter, and every time you made a mistake, you had to rip it out and start all over, and you know, and now you can just, it's amazing, you can eliminate half of your secretarial help because of the high tech nature of things. So yeah, it's no doubt about it that the technology has eliminated an awful lot of jobs. And of course, when you've got a society that's built on labor that wants $30-$40 an hour, it's hard to compete with the rest of the world.
Well, that's why they're shifting so many of the clerical jobs and telephone answering jobs and support jobs over to India and Bangladesh and Pakistan. And, IBM has moved over 10,000 jobs into India. And the argument is, well, you know, that means that they can produce their goods so much more cheaply, and that Americans then can buy these goods so much more cheaply because the expense is less because all their jobs are in India. And the answer to that, of course, is yes, but we've got an awful lot of people here who don't have jobs and they can't afford to buy anything. Well, we've got Lisa calling from Santa Cruz. What to do with the debt? Lisa, go ahead. What is your question specifically?
Specifically, what do you suggest for the general public who is in debt, and how do we go about this kind of crisis? Obviously, New World Order kind of take over.
All right. So you're asking what you should do if you're in debt?
Yeah. How are we going to get out of it? I mean, if everything falls apart, what happens to our debt? How are we going to get out of debt if we can't make the money to get out of debt?
All right, Ron, how would you respond to Lisa? She says, look, how are we going to get out of debt if we can't make the money to get out of debt?
You know, that, of course, is a tough decision. You know, to the extent that someone has some money to invest, they have to, one, get it out of dollar-type investments, which at best are going to stay on the treadmill. You're not going to get ahead with investments in dollars that are losing value faster than they're earning income. So you have to find some investment that gives you hope of making a big return, and that's why I love silver. I honestly believe silver is, as I've said on the show many times, Dr. Stan, silver is the investment opportunity not only of everyone's lifetime, but it literally is everyone. It's the investment opportunity of world history. If people could just understand that the world has consumed in the last 40 years 95% of the silver that took 4,000 years to accumulate, and silver becomes more and more critical the more high-tech we become, silver becomes more important as people lose confidence in paper money. So, to me, the only hope for the person who's hopelessly in debt is to put their money into something that has a chance to make 10, 20, 30 times on their money, and I think that would be silver.
Now, several things, Lisa. First of all, if you have any money at all to invest, invest it. Try to get out of debt as much as you can. But at times that such as Lyhead are traditionally where where wealth goes from weak hands to strong hands. And there are an awful lot of people out there who have homes that they've just got a tremendous debt on. If they lose their job, they're not going to be able to pay the payments on their home. They're going to lose their homes. People are going to lose their cars. Are there going to be tremendous numbers of foreclosures out there? And they're going to be very, very difficult times. You never want to be in debt. And if there's any way you can get out of debt as much as you can, get out of debt. But I think Ron's idea that at least if you have any money at all, try to invest it in something that really is going to go up. And I sure wouldn't be investing in most stocks in the stock market today. The only thing I would even consider would be gold and silver stocks.
Absolutely.
Anything else, Lisa? But an awful lot of people are going to lose everything. And how the internationalists who've created this problem are going to get out of this system? Is they're eventually going to destroy the value of the dollar, and then anything that's denominated in dollar debt, of course, won't be worth anything. In other words, they will destroy the value of the dollar, and the debt won't exist as such. That's what I really think they're going to do. But in the meantime, there's going to be terrible suffering on the parts of our people. And I do what I do, trying to warn people, get out of debt, batter down the hatches, don't believe what the government is telling you, and realize, of course, we are moving into one of the periods of crisis and chaos unlike anything we've ever seen during our lifetime.
How do we spread the awareness to the people?
Well, I'll tell you what, here on Radio Liberty, this program is heard on shortwave across America starting next Monday. Why, we'll be in Chicago, we'll be in Detroit, we'll be in Flint, we'll be in Utica, New York, we'll be in Albany, New York, we'll be in Fort Wayne, Indiana, I think it is. And you can help us, if there's any way you can help Radio Liberty. We have to buy our time on radio stations, but we have a unique opportunity to reach people across this country. And they'll be listening to the same 2 hours in those major markets that you're listening to here. We'll be on satellite as well, and we hope that other stations will pull us down. So, Lisa, help us to get the word out if you can, okay?
Thank you.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, these are exciting times for Radio Liberty. Ron, let's get your telephone number out just one more time.
It's 1-800-595-0561.
And, of course, Ron's one of our supporters. He's an honest man, and I don't hesitate at all to recommend him to you. Thanks very much for being with us, and we'll be talking to you on one of our other programs later this week.
Good to be with you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. And, of course, hang on. We'll just be wrapping up the program here in just a moment or two here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and if you study the history of finances throughout the world, you'll find that there's nothing new under the sun. Time and time again, they've tried exactly what's happening today. Back in the days of the Caesars, they tried to have artificial prosperity by creating coins that really were of relatively little value, to devalue the coins. Diocletian tried to create a tremendous prosperity by devaluing and destroying the value of the currency. And then, of course, he had to put on wage and price controls to try to counter the effect of what he had done by debasing the currency. And it was the debasing of the currency in Rome, there in the 400s, that led to the gradual demoralization of society. And eventually, in about 470, 475, when the Huns came in, there was nobody there to actually be concerned about what was going on. People had become so disillusioned with society. There was immorality and homosexuality, and the family was destroyed. But part of that went along with the debasement of the currency. Now, what most people do not remember or realize is that the Roman Empire had been split into two parts by Diocletian. And one part was in Rome, and the other part was in Constantinople. And, of course, you remember, of course, Constantine succeeded Diocletian, became the Roman Caesar, and eventually legalized and then embraced the Christian religion. But the Byzantine Empire, which was established in Constantinople, maintained a stable currency, whereas the western branch of the Roman Empire went on into a fiat money system, the eastern branch kept a gold dinar as a currency means of exchange, and their society existed up into the 1200s when it was finally overrun by the Muslims. But a stable monetary system is the key to a stable society. You can go back and you can see what happened in France in the early 1700s when the king was bankrupt and he didn't know what he was going to do. He wasn't getting enough money and by taxes to pay all of his bills. And when the king is bankrupt, what do you do? Well, there was a Scotsman from Edinburgh named John Law who said, look, I can come in. I can create all the money you need. We'll just print paper money. And he did. And France prospered and the king prospered and the only trouble is they expanded the money supply, why the value of the paper currency began to decline, so they had to print more paper money, and more paper money, and more paper money, and eventually, in the early 1700s, the whole economy of France collapsed under the weight of a fiat money system. And you would think they would have learned from that, but they did exactly the same thing after the French Revolution. And if you need to hear that study, that's called The Fiat Money Inflation in France, available from Radio Liberty. Well, there's one book, if you really want to understand the monetary system. It's called Fiat Money Inflation in France. It's written by Andrew Dickinson White, who was the president of Yale University 150 years ago. And he was writing at that time about what had happened in France following the French Revolution 100 years before that. And, of course, the phony monetary system that they created based upon a fiat money system, a paper money system, created tremendous artificial prosperity. They had a stock market at that time. The stock market soared. And, of course, with this artificial prosperity, there seemed to be almost like an end to morality. These ideas of being married and faithful to your spouse, these ideas sort of began to disappear, and there was a moral and religious breakdown in France at that time, and of course each time they printed more paper money, it created more prosperity, and then of course eventually things began to equalize, and then they had to print more paper money until finally it was not occasionally turning on the printing presses, they had to keep them running all the time, and eventually the monetary system collapsed, and out of the chaos in France came a man, the new leader of France. His name was Napoleon Bonaparte. And, of course, he was to be the savior of the revolution, the French Revolution, and soon he was the new emperor, a new dictator. And what usually happens is, out of course, the chaos of monetary destruction, comes a new form of government. I believe that this is what's intended. That will be a new world order, a new world religion, ruled by a ruling elite. Well, this is the time, of course, when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. I mentioned earlier the book, Fiat Money Inflation in France. You can get that by calling 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. It's a classic book on the fiat money system and what eventually happens. It's sold in combination with a book called The Law by Frederick Bastiat, written in 1848 by a man who was a contemporary of Karl Marx. It was Bastiat's response to Karl Marx and his ideas of socialism. And, of course, Bastiat was talking about individual freedom in France. So those books are so important. The Law and the Fiat Money Inflation in France are important to read, but we do hope that many of you out there will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do, 5 hours every day, 4 hours now every day on shortwave. The new stations we're going to be going to back in the east, and of course we have the for this program, the four stations up in the northwest and the American Christian Network. But, of course, all of this is expensive. We hope that you'll want to join us in this epic struggle to disseminate information with the realization that if the people don't understand, then freedom will be lost. What was it says in Hosea 4:6, something about my people perish from lack of knowledge? Well, America will perish unless the American people understand what's going on. And I don't know a better way to reach people than talk radio. And Radio Liberty is on the front line. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family or help us, our number 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. please go to our website at radioliberty.com. And, of course, you can pull down our programs. You can read our newsletter. If you'd like a free copy of our latest newsletter, the December newsletter, which, of course, tells why the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools, the January newsletter tells you about the Illuminati. It tells you exactly what George Washington said about the Illuminati. What the president of Yale said about the Illuminati on July 4th, 1798. His name was Timothy Dwight. That was the grandson of Jonathan Edwards. And, of course, the information is there. It's in our January newsletter. We'd be glad to send it to you. Most people don't even know that the Illuminati came to America, or that the Illuminati is still here in the upper echelons of Masonry. Well, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening at the same time, when we'll be with you once again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty.
Oh.
Coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have with us right now Lorraine Murray, and she is a nuclear scientist. She worked at the Livermore laboratory there, and she, of course, became very, very concerned because the information, the truth, is being withheld from the American people about the dangers of depleted uranium as we scattered literally hundreds of tons of this radioactive material throughout the world, in Kosovo and Bosnia, during the first Gulf War, in Kuwait and southern Iraq, and now throughout the cities of Iraq. They're not only exposing the Iraqi civilians, but the American troops to this very lethal product. And so, without further ado, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Oh, good evening.
Well, now, why don't you tell us just a little bit about your background and how it happened that you actually were willing to break ranks with so many of the other scientists and tell the truth about what's going on. Of course, that is a very expensive thing to do because you become a whistleblower and you lose your job when you do that, don't you?
You lose more than that. But I think you get your freedom, and it's really having the freedom to be able to speak out. It came at a high price, but I think I'm doing the most interesting and the most important thing that I'll ever do as a scientist.
All right, fine. Now, you are trained in nuclear science and Yes. Physics or what?
Yes, I'm a geoscientist, which is an interdisciplinary discipline.
All right.
And so it combines physics, chemistry, mathematics, computer science, just about everything, biology. Everything is involved in understanding the Earth and Earth processes, and it's a very, very good background to become involved with radiation.
All right. Well, then, first, you became concerned about the depleted uranium that's being used as a weapon, certainly in the Gulf War, and is being used as one of our primary weapon systems throughout the world. So why don't you tell our listeners what you've learned about this? Because certainly our government and our military leaders are saying there's nothing to worry about. After all, it's depleted uranium. It's depleted. Why worry about it? Are they playing games with words? Are they concealing the truth, the very real danger for the American people?
Well, we know they've played many games with the American people, and the most dangerous and the most deceptive game of all has been the game of radiation. And we know now that the nuclear weapons fallout from testing, atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons and underground testing also, because that leaks too, has cost a tremendous number of lives. We have a global cancer epidemic now, which is the result of atmospheric testing, and other radiation-related diseases. I work with a group of scientists who study nuclear power plants and the low-level radioactive fallout, the impact on human health, and especially the babies and children.
Well, let's talk specifically about the depleted uranium.
Okay.
I know you're ready on and all these other things, but what about the danger of depleted uranium as far as the military, as far as the civilians in the areas where the depleted uranium has been disseminated?
Well, the depleted uranium is the blueprint for depleted uranium.
Hold that thought for just a moment there. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Lorraine Murray, and we're talking about, of course, depleted uranium. And she worked for the Livermore Laboratories as a scientist, and now, of course, she's with another group trying to bring the truth out that you're not getting from Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Russ Limbaugh, or Bill O'Reilly. So pick up with the story there, Lorraine.
Yes. Well, what I'll do is talk about the blueprint for depleted uranium and let the listeners make up their own minds. The blueprint for depleted uranium is a document, a memo to General Leslie Groves, dated October 30th, 1943.
Now, Leslie Groves was in charge of the Manhattan Project that was
producing the
atom bomb, right?
That's right. This is part of the Manhattan Project, and it's a memo written by the three top physicists in the Manhattan Project, Drs. Conant, Compton, and Urey. And these three physicists comprised a subcommittee of the S1 Executive Committee on the Use of Radioactive Materials as a Military Weapon. And in this memo, they recommended developing the radioactive trash, in other words, the fission products and the depleted uranium, from the A-bomb project. They still didn't even know if the atomic bombs would work. So they said, well, let's just make weapons for the battlefield out of this radioactive trash.
Now, this was what they had used then. Was this the depleted uranium, the uranium that was left over after they'd extracted the uranium-235?
Yes, that's right. And when you mine uranium, it occurs in three natural isotopes, and only one can be used in nuclear weapons and nuclear reactors. So that's only 0.5% that's useful. So
that might be a 0.5 pound out of 100 pounds.
That's right. And so 99.5% of what they mine is useless. It's called depleted uranium because it's depleted in that one special isotope, U-235.
But all the rest of it is radioactive, and it is radioactive uranium. It's just not as radioactive as the 235. Would that be a fair statement?
It has a longer half-life, but when you inhale radiation, the local dose of, for instance, one alpha particle from depleted uranium, the local effect to the cell or the two cells where it lodges, it's equivalent to 50 times the annual whole body dose, which is allowed under international law.
Hold that thought. All right, I guess it's Ren Murray. We're talking about the fact that when you inhale this depleted uranium, and what was that figure you used?
Oh, one single alpha particle is equivalent to 50 times what the allowable dose is per year for the whole body.
Just one little particle.
That's right.
All right. Because the alpha particles are constantly barraging and attacking the tissues of the body, aren't they?
That's right.
They're different than the beta particles. In fact, you don't pick up the alpha particles with a Geiger counter, do you?
You don't pick it up with a Geiger counter because they have such a short half-life. You need a big pancake-shaped special counter to detect them.
All right. But, of course, once they get in the body, they begin playing havoc with the body. And, of course, if you have depleted uranium, you've got an awful lot of alpha particles out there, don't you?
Oh, my God. Dr. Hari Sharma in Canada measured the levels of depleted uranium in 71 dead residents of Basra in southern Iraq after the 1991 Gulf War. And they had 150 micrograms per kilogram of tissue, which is 10 alpha particles going off every second in their body.
Well, now, of course, did these people die of radiation poisoning, or did they die of or other causes?
Oh, they died of cancer almost immediately, very, very quickly after the Gulf War. And
this was after the first Gulf War.
After the first Gulf War, and even though Basra was a couple of hundred miles from the battlefield, just as has happened to people in Utah and Nevada who were downwind from atmospheric testing, these people inhaled the depleted uranium. It's an invisible poison in the air. You can't even smell it or taste it. You don't know it's there. And each day that they're breathing, the levels are increasing in their bodies.
Well, now, then, is the better significant increase in the incidence of cancer in Iraqi civilians in this last 10 years?
It's gone up hundreds of times.
You mean 100% or?
Oh, more than 100%.
Several hundred percent?
Maybe over 300.
All right. Of course, what about the American servicemen that came back from the Gulf War? What is the incidence of cancer in them? Because we know that certainly there are over 200,000 of the 695,000 men we sent over. The Veterans Department, Veterans Administration, will admit have a legitimate disease, and some people say even as many as another couple of hundred thousand can't get their disease acknowledged by the Veterans Administration.
Yes.
What about the incidence of cancer and those young American boys who went overseas to fight for freedom in 1990 and 1991?
The out of about 700,000 who came back, about 450,000 were exposed to DU. 245,000 are on permanent medical disability now, and more than 10,000 are dead. They cannot get medical care, so there are really very, very little statistics or information about them. And also, the uranium oxides that form on the battlefield are biologically unpredictable. So Gulf War syndrome, which is what people call it's just a horrible basket of illnesses that these Gulf War veterans are suffering from, it's cancer is just one of them.
All right, so basically there are a number of causes of Gulf War illness. One is probably mycoplasma infection of the vaccines. And may even be experimental vaccines for all we know. Another would be depleted uranium. Another would be the pyridostigmine bromide that the troops are required to utilize. This is a drug that is given to people with myasthenia gravis who kind of die, and they all die. And so we gave the drug to our troops to see what would happen, And a lot of them got very, very ill from it. And then it combined with DEET, which was a pesticide that was, their uniforms were impregnated with. And then they came in contact with the fires from the Gulf War, the oil fires. And there were lots of other chemicals and pollutants they came in contact with, weren't there?
You're absolutely right. They were exposed to a very, very toxic soup on the battlefield.
And then, of course, there was also the sarin gas that when we blew up the bunkers there in Kamishia.
That's right. That's right. It was many, many things. But biologically, ionizing radiation has an effect which is 10 to 100 million times greater than chemical exposure. And another danger is that the DU is very low-level radiation, which has a greater harmful effect, just as very low levels of some chemicals do. It has a greater effect per unit dose than higher levels.
Well, could you tell us, you read me this afternoon, this statement that was made by this government official of writing to Governor, General Groves, and they were talking about how they could utilize this material, this depleted uranium, as it were, as a war weapon, a weapon of war for the Second World War. Could you develop that idea?
Yes. This is some of the details I'm going to read straight from the declassified document I referred to, the memo to General Leslie Groves. Quote, as a gas warfare instrument, the material would be ground into particles of microscopic size to form dust and smoke and distributed by a ground-fired projectile, land vehicles, or aerial bombs. In this form, it would be inhaled by personnel. The amount necessary to cause death to a person inhaling the material is extremely small. It has been estimated that 1/1,000,000 of a gram accumulating in a person's body would be fatal. There are no known methods of treatment for such a casualty. Here's another thing. Two factors appear to increase the effectiveness of radioactive dust or smoke as a weapon. These are, it cannot be detected by the senses, and it can be distributed in a dust or smoke form so finely powdered that it will permeate a standard gas mask filter in quantities large enough to be extremely damaging. Also, areas so contaminated by radioactive material would be dangerous until the slow, natural decay of the material took place.
Well, then we're talking about, 4,000 years or 400,000 years?
No, for depleted uranium, it's 4.5 billion years.
Well, that takes quite a while, then.
The age of the Earth, yes. And just to make sure that we understand what the intent was of Dr. Conant, this is a quote by him, quote, to me, the development of new and more effective gases seemed no more immoral than the manufacture of explosives and guns. I did not see in 1917 and do not see in 1968 why tearing a man's guts out by a high explosive shell is to be preferred to maiming him by attacking his lungs or skin. And in the memo, they also talk about internal exposure to the lungs. Particles larger than 1 micron in size are likely to be deposited in the nose, trachea, or bronchi. Particles smaller than 1 micron are more likely to be deposited in the alveoli, where they will either remain indefinitely or be absorbed in the lymphatics or the blood. The probability of the deposition of dust particles anywhere in the respiratory tract depends upon respiratory rate, particle size, chemical and physical nature, and the concentration in the atmosphere. And they knew that the effects on the lungs would be a delayed effect, and the harm would begin to be noticeable months after exposure.
All right. So they were well aware of this back in the 1940s then, that the dust that came from depleted uranium or grinding up depleted uranium could very well be lethal. Now, explain to our listeners, can you, how this depleted uranium becomes a dust on the battlefields of Basra or of Baghdad? How does it come? Because you can actually pick up these shells, you know, they're made of depleted uranium, but they seem to handle them without gloves or anything. So how does this then become dangerous?
Depleted uranium has a quality that other radioactive materials that were trashed in the A-bomb project do not have. Depleted uranium is pyrophoric, which means it is a metal that will almost spontaneously begin to burn. So
once it's fired and through a muzzle, is that it?
Yes, that's right. Just the friction in the gun barrel on a tank or a plane or even in a handgun will cause the metal to begin burning. And if you see films of battlefields, you can see the depleted uranium shells going through the dark, and they're on fire.
Like a tracer would be.
They look like tracers, that's right. And the bombs, 5,000-pound bombs, are full of depleted uranium, and when they hit the ground, they just splatter into many tiny fragments that are all on fire. So that fire at very high temperatures, between 3,000 and 5,000 degrees centigrade, creates very, very large numbers of very tiny particles. A tenth of a micron is the average size, which is it's about the size of bacteria, but even it gets smaller than viruses.
Now, basically, this is uranium oxide dust. Would that be a fair statement?
That's right. These are insoluble uranium oxide dust that form when it burns.
All right, fine. And so then, of course, it's lying on the ground there, or it's in the buildings, it's in the walls, it's in the air.
It's everywhere.
And, of course, people will inhale, and they'll inhale it, get it in their lungs, and then, of course, it begins to go to work on their bodies a little bit by little bit, eroding and destroying them. Would that be a fair statement?
That's exactly what it does. It's the weapon that works from the inside out. Nuclear weapons and other weapons work from the outside in.
And, of course, really what's so frightening about this is our government knows how dangerous it is, not only to the enemy, but to our own soldiers. And yet they've made nothing at all to protect them, and they're lying when they say there's nothing to worry about.
The cover...
Hold on just one moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest, Lorraine Murray, and we're talking about depleted uranium. Pick up the story from there, please, Lorraine.
Yes, the cover-up, well, depleted uranium was used on the battlefield for the first time in 1991, and that was in Desert Storm in the Gulf region. The United States broke a 46-year taboo against using radioactive weapons on the battlefield, and by the way, they are illegal under all international laws, under all international war conventions, the Geneva Conventions, so forth, and all treaties and agreements. So they've always been illegal. The United States government spent billions of dollars on depleted uranium, testing it on the battle, on the testing grounds and the bombing ranges. 42 states are now contaminated in the U.S., and we know about Vieques, Puerto Rico, where half of the population is dying of cancer.
No, wait a minute. Half the population of what is dying of cancer?
There are about 12,000 Puerto Ricans on the island of Vieques, and the Navy has used it as a bombing range for over 50 years.
Now, what percentage of the population has cancer?
I would say half of them. 6,000 people have radiation illnesses, and many of them have cancer.
Is this written up anyplace?
Oh, my gosh, yes. Many members of Congress have been down in to visit Vieques, and after years of protesting, the Vieques Islanders finally forced the Navy just a few months ago to leave Vieques Island.
All right, so they won't use it anymore, but if they, of course, you've got the radioactive dust there, they must made large parts of the island totally uninhabitable.
But the people, it's their home. They don't want to leave, so...
But weren't they still in danger of...
Of course. They where would they go?
I'm just not asking. I'm just saying that these people obviously are in danger because of the radioactive exposure. But then, of course, what about the people of Iraq? Aren't the areas where certainly the military was in there just blowing things up and, certainly those Apache helicopters coming in firing 4,000 bullets a minute. And they're all, of course, uranium-tipped. They're not uranium-tipped, they're solid uranium. They all, of course, then become uranium dust. And those buildings must be heavily contaminated.
It's all contaminated, and it's really a tragedy. I'd like to read a quote from Henry Kissinger. This is from 1990, from a book called Kiss the Boys Goodbye, How the United States Betrayed Its Own POWs in Vietnam, and it's just as relevant now. Henry Kissinger said, "Military men are just dumb, stupid animals to be used as pawns in foreign policy."
In fact, we always quote that similar statement is quoted in a book called The Last Days, page 194, by Woodward Bernstein, quoting Henry Kissinger as saying, "Our military men are stupid, dumb animals, so they're really not concerned that they're going to die of terrible deaths because of depleted uranium." After all, Henry Kissinger is a member of the elite. He's part of this group that rules the world and concerned about the people who are foolish enough to join the military and go overseas to fight for freedom, because he doesn't believe in freedom and he doesn't believe in our military. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Lorraine Murray, and if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Now, my understanding is you've testified all over the world about the dangers of depleted uranium. And in many countries, this danger is well known and recognized, and yet because of the degree of control of the media here in the United States, this information is not getting out, except perhaps programs such as ours and on the Internet. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, that would be a very fair statement, and I would like to thank you, not just for me and other concerned scientists and medical experts who are working to get the truth out, but to thank you for the veterans who've been exposed, and some of them don't even know it. Many of them don't know it. They came home from Iraq after 1991, and they brought the DU home with them. They had semen contaminated with DU, and when they had intercourse with their wives, they internally contaminated their wives. The children born after the Gulf War, two Gulf War veterans, in one study on 250 Gulf War veterans from Mississippi, the Department of Veterans Affairs, a government agency, deemed that 67% of the children born after the Gulf War were born with severe birth defects. In other words, without ears, without eyes, or without brains, with organs missing, with terrible radiation-related diseases.
And haven't they actually shown over in Great Britain that there is a chromosomal aberration? And didn't just within the last few weeks a British soldier actually get compensated by the British government for his DU contamination?
This is one of the first victories. It's a very, very, very important case, and I really sense in the last week or two something is happening about the DU issue and what's happening in Iraq, because there is much more interest in it, and I've been doing a lot of interviews, and I just spoke with NHK Television in Japan tonight. They interviewed me for an hour, and they said there's a lot of interest suddenly about the DU issue.
But, of course, most of this is throughout the rest of the world rather than here in America, where it should be, because we're the source of where it's coming from. And unless the American people understand and bring pressure to bear, we'll continue using this, continue contaminating it, and continue ignoring our sick veterans.
I think people really don't understand that the United States has staged a nuclear war in Iraq, Bosnia, Kosovo, and Afghanistan. And when I attended and presented at the World Depleted Uranium Weapons Conference in Hamburg, Germany in October, a Professor Yagasaki from Japan, who is a physicist, came, and he had calculated that 800 tons of depleted uranium is the atomicity equivalent, the equal number of atoms, to 83,000 Nagasaki bombs. If that is true, and I believe he was correct, the United States has used the equivalent of 400,000 Nagasaki bombs in Iraq, the former Yugoslavia, and Afghanistan.
You're talking now about, of course, the comparable amount of radiation.
That's right.
Okay, let's go to Ed, who's calling us here from Aptos, been waiting on the line very patiently. Hi, Ed, do you have another question?
A brief question and a comment.
Okay.
I wanted to ask your guest if she's ever heard of a Dr. Bill Wattenberg.
Yes.
Yeah, he's up in the northern station up there. And my comment is, all the sheeple that call into his cheesy radio station, he always tells them how it's completely safe, depleted uranium. That's what depleted means. There's no uranium in it. And he's always telling them how safe it is. That's all I had to say. And I wonder what you thought of that.
I'm a whistleblower at the Livermore Nuclear Weapons Lab. I left in 1991 because of the science fraud and the lies and the racketeering and all of that. And he has very, very strong ties to the Livermore Lab.
Are you suggesting that he might not be completely forthright?
I know he's not. I've listened to his program. In fact, I've called in.
I see. And what sort of response did you get when you told him who you were and that you were a scientist as well?
Oh, he just attacks you. It's just an attack. He's just one of the bulldogs for the Department of Energy and the nuclear weapons program. There are lots of them.
Are you suggesting that maybe they have people out there that are intentionally lying and deceiving the American people, that they have planted people within the media not to tell us the truth?
They have people everywhere. That's why the whole secrecy has prevented American citizens from knowing how they've been impacted by all of this radiation.
Hold on, we'll be right back here. It's with Lorraine. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I guess this afternoon is Lorraine Murray, and she was a whistleblower, worked there at the Livermore Laboratory, and of course left to try to get the truth out about so many of the things that were going on. And one of them, of course, is the disastrous effects of depleted uranium. Now, you can go up on the internet, as I have, and you can go to traprockpeace.org. That's traprockpeace.org. Tremendous number of great interviews there. And then, of course, I was on another website. What's that website that you're on so much?
www.mindfully.org. And if you click on nuclear, select nuclear, there are many topics, many very good articles and testimony and so forth on radiation.
But if you go down the bottom, you'll find one that's in yellow, and that's one of Lorraine's articles. And what is that article really about? That's an article or a letter you wrote to a legislator, isn't it?
Yes, it's a letter I wrote last spring, just before the Iraq War started, to Congressman McDermott, and he's from Seattle, Washington. He introduced a depleted uranium bill in Congress demanding studies and training and so forth for affected veterans.
Well, of course, did the bill get enacted, or was it...
The problem is he's a Democrat, so in a Republican-controlled Congress, it's not going to go anywhere, but it keeps the issue on the table. And you know, you were asking me if people would actually be deceptive about radiation. I'd like to read a quote from the minutes of an Atomic Energy Commission meeting in 1956. And these are the words taken from the meeting transcript of the Director of Health and Safety, Merrill Eisenbud. Again, he was with the Atomic Energy Commission. This is what he said about the Marshall Islands. Rongelap is safe to live on, but is by far the most contaminated place in the world. And it will be very interesting to go back and get good environmental data. While it is true that these people do not live the way Westerners do, civilized people, it is nevertheless also true that these people are more like us than the mice.
They're more like us than the mice. In other words, this is really sort of an experiment to see what's going to happen to these people after being chronically exposed to radiation. Was that sort of the general thought?
That was where the first A-bomb testing started.
Hold that thought for just a moment
here.
Okay, this is Dr. Stan, and of course we're talking with Lorraine Murray about the dangers of radiation, but specifically on the dangers of depleted uranium. And of course, we have so many people who've been seriously injured by this. We've had as a guest here in the past a Major Doug Rocky, who was in charge of the military cleanup effort after the first Gulf War. And he says that of the 100 men who were very close to him or were working with him, they're all sick. And a significant number of have developed one form or another cancer and have died. And these are, remember, these were men in the peak of health. These were warriors. These were, you know, almost like professional athletes in 1991. And, of course, so many of them are ill and almost dead today. And many of them have actually died. And the fact you're not hearing about this across America is simply a reflection of the degree of control that exists today of what the American people think and how effectively people like Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw are in influencing the American people and concealing from them the very real truth of what's going on today. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Oh, I would completely agree with that. And so many more people now are turning to the Internet for news and information because they know the U.S. media, and in England too, is so controlled.
Well, of course, we're hoping that they'll want to get onto our shortwave programs now that we're here 4 hours a day on shortwave at 5.745 megahertz, and they'll be even getting their shortwave radios so they can listen to us, and then they can get us on the Internet 5 hours a day. And then, of course, what we need to do is get onto all sorts of stations for people who don't know there's a problem, and we're going to be picking up 5 additional stations the first of next week. And so we're gradually expanding our audience, and people will be just driving down the road. They'll just surf the dial. They'll hear what we say, and hopefully something that they say will ring a bell, or that we say will ring a bell, and they'll begin to research and find out, and suddenly came to that horrible conclusion that the American media is controlled and that they've been lied to almost all of their lives, just like it was in the Truman Show. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. If you have a question for Lorraine, and she's been all over the world actually testifying about the dangers of depleted uranium. Aren't many of the other countries of the world very upset about what's going on?
Oh, very, very upset. And I just came back from the World Social Forum in Mumbai, which is the former Bombay, India. And there were 100,000 people who attended this conference. I was interviewed on television, satellite TV, which was shown in 27 countries. And I talked about the DU issue, and I talked about the nuclear war the U.S. has staged. And these are dirty bombs that the U.S. has used. And that television station had hundreds of phone calls by the next morning from countries in the Middle East. And people said, we really, really liked that bold interview, and we knew the U.S. was bombing all this time, but we didn't know why. Now we understand the purpose of all of that bombing.
So that shock and awe was really the strike of a nuclear attack on Iraq.
Because that's what it really was.
Because when they were using the bombs, they were all depleted uranium, and the byproduct of the depleted uranium dust is mass contamination of the entire nation.
I have one interview from an Army colonel who was actually selecting targets in the March and April, the 2003 war, and he confessed to have ordered 500 tons, just him, on targets. How many military officers were sitting there ordering bombing and gunnery attacks on targets all over Iraq? The whole country is bombed into radioactive rubble. That dust, that radioactive dust, will go all over the Arabian Peninsula, Israel, Turkey, Iran, and from the bombing in Afghanistan, it will go over the northern half of India. And eventually that radiation attached to atmospheric dust will go around and around the world. My PhD research has been on atmospheric dust.
Well, of course, there are some people out there who believe there are too many people in the world and we should reduce the population down to 2 billion,
that
1 billion, 500 million. In fact, David Foreman thinks we ought to get the world population down to 100 million. And Jacques Cousteau, I don't know if you're acquainted with his quotation, being interviewed for an article that appeared in the November 1991 issue of UNESCO, Courier said, well, it's a terrible thing to say, but we're going to have to eliminate 350,000 people a day. It's terrible to have to say it, but we're going to have to do it. We're going to have to eliminate 350,000 people a day. Totally blacked out by the controlled media. I have an article written by a fellow from the CIA who talked about the fact that when he was in the CIA, he got information that there was a plan to kill off large parts of the world population. I actually talked to him and asked him, what are you talking about? And he said, well, he'd gotten the information suggesting that a man named Maurice Strong was involved with a group that wanted to dramatically decrease the population of the world. Do you think this is how they're going to do it?
Oh, actually, I have a news article. I couldn't believe it. It was in the mainstream media in June, and the Pentagon actually announced that half of the world's population needed to be eliminated. This has been proposed for a long time. It's not a new idea, and it's not outrageous. They actually plan to do it. When I was in India and I spoke with medical doctors and the top admiral in the military, Admiral Bhagwat, who is the father of the Indian submarine, they told me that India is flooded for the last 3 years with drugs and drug money, billions and billions of dollars that is being redirected from the Burma Triangle. Citicorp banks and auto tellers are going up all over the country, and there are now FBI and DEA offices in their cities. And they also...
Are they there to fight drugs or are they to promote the drug trafficking?
Oh, no, this is to make money. And it's to corrupt the police officials, the customs officials, to buy off elected officials.
You're saying that we have our officials over there corrupting their officials to allow the drug trade?
Yes, 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 that's right. One, the top medical professional, a woman doctor in India, came to my press conference, and she has already caught one elected official with $7 billion? $7 billion? How would anybody in India accumulate that much money?
And you had that much, what would you do with it?
What would you do with it? I was just astounded, and the Indians were hysterical, and when I showed them the contamination map for depleted uranium, they said, it completely makes sense because the whole southern half of India is now contaminated with AIDS.
Oh, now, you're talking now as far as the drugs and the spread of AIDS.
Right. I guess
that's different than, of course, the depleted uranium, which is in the North out.
Well, they both eliminate people.
Oh, they do. And if we really were trying to stop the AIDS epidemic, we're doing a terrible job. If we were trying to use AIDS to kill off a large part of the world's population, say in Africa, we're in Botswana, almost 30% of the adult population are infected, we actually are doing a magnificent job. The question is, what's our real motivation?
Well,
if we are trying to stop the epidemic, how could you do such a bad job unintentionally?
I have another question. I'm an environmental commissioner in the city of Berkeley, and any time that UC Berkeley or the Lawrence Berkeley Lab have plans to build new facilities, they have to come and inform the city government. And what I found out by being on the Environmental Commission is that Rumsfeld has been pouring billions of dollars into building bioweapons level 4 laboratories all over the United States. And in fact, he even proposed to build one at UC Davis, which is where my daughter is an undergraduate. And they wanted to build one at the Livermore Lab. They're putting them all over the United States on college campuses. And
these are bioweapons for, this is what the most dangerous of all bioweapons. These would be like Ebola and similar infections.
That's right. It's where a single piece of virus, a single bacteria can be lethal.
Right.
And so if the United States is not intending to use these weapons, what are they building all these facilities for?
Well, I would ask another question. If we're not planning on using anthrax as a biological weapon, why is it we're so intent upon vaccinating all of our troops when somebody of them had reactions to it? And you would never want to vaccinate your troops because you don't know what variation of anthrax it would be. The only reason you would vaccinate your troops against anthrax is if you knew exactly which strains were going to be released.
That's
and how
right.
would you know it? Unless you were planning on releasing it yourself. And nobody wants to ask that question because it is too horrible to contemplate. If you're out there in the listening audience and you're hearing this program and you say, I don't believe any of this. I had a fellow call me today and when I explained to him tried to answer his questions, he became furious. He called me a liar. Well, if you would like to see the article out of the UNESCO Courier where they quote Jacques Cousteau, who said, we must eliminate 350,000 people a day. Why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll send you the pages, copies of the pages out of the UNESCO Courier.
Oh, Dr. Montes, I would really like to have a copy of that.
Well, that's where you come here for this original source material. We have so much of this source material. And you give me a call or get your telephone, your address, or maybe I'll tell you what, at the end of the program, I'll just put you on hold. I'll have Andy get your address, and we'll send you that copy of the UNESCO Courier.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so important, you know, when you're doing what I do, to have the documentation for what you say, because the story is so incredible, I don't even believe it, and I have to constantly go to this documentation to remind myself that we're really talking about we're living in a nightmare.
I don't talk about anything unless I'm sitting there with the documentation on the table. And last summer, I spent the summer in Japan educating prosecutors and lawyers about depleted uranium. I carried 50 pounds of documents and videos with me every single day, everywhere I went. And the media interviewed me dozens and dozens of times. They put me on television. But it's because I had the internal official government documents.
Well, I think really it's so important to realize that other countries know what's going on.
Other countries know what's going on. Americans have no idea.
And of course, once we can convince the American people that the media lies, at that point, at least some of the people are going to begin to wake up to what's going on. Because this, in fact, this is really what got me started in this whole battle 42 years ago, was I turned on the wrong television program and I heard old man talking about how we'd brought Fidel Castro to power knowing he was a communist. how America was not a democracy, it was a republic, and the media was controlled. And so I set out to prove him wrong, and I started a 42-year odyssey that has brought me to where I am today, with an understanding that the media is controlled. We did bring Fidel Castro to power, and we've kept him in power because he's one of the best enemies that our own money could buy. And, of course, America is not a democracy. It never was, because democracies always eventually become tyrannical. We were a republic. Tragically, we lost that. And we are moving rapidly towards the New World Order, the New World Religion, under the control of a ruling elite. And, of course, this is going to happen within a relatively short period of time, unless you out there in the listening audience can help us reach the remainder of the population with an understanding of what's going on. Now, as far as the depleted uranium is concerned, our boys are coming home. Is there any treatment at all for them? I understand that Colonel Asad Durakovich, we're going to be having him on, I believe, next week or maybe later this week. Is there any treatment at all for our boys that are contaminated?
There is very little that can be done, and I mean that was even in the Groves memo. They knew in 1943 that once you're internally contaminated with radiation, there's very, very little that can be done. However, people can eat food and fruits and vegetables that have a lot of free radicals. Food that is highly colored, vegetables and fruit that have a lot of color to them, have a lot of free radicals. And what these are sort of protective chemicals. When they get in the cell, they cancel out the harm from the radiation. But once the harm has been done, it's pretty much irreversible. It's just such a tragedy. We need to stop the use of these before people get contaminated.
Well, of course, prevention is always a lot better than the cure, but the tragedy is the government doesn't want to give up this very effective weapon, because the depleted uranium is one of the finest weapons on the battlefield. And, of course, the purpose of battlefield weapons is to kill people and destroy things.
That's right.
And that's exactly what this does. But at what a terrible price in human suffering afterwards. And yet the military has no intention of giving up their effective tool, no matter how many American boys will die because of this, not only killing the enemies, but killing our own people. But then if you understand the feeling of men like Henry Kissinger, they have been quoted as saying, and the quotation that Loren gave from Kiss the Boys Goodbye, and that I can give from page 194 of The Final Days by Woodward and Bernstein. Kissinger quoted as saying, our military is made up of stupid, dumb animals to be used for foreign policy purposes. Remember, of course, Henry Kissinger is a very close friend of the President of the United States.
That's right. I'd like to read another a U.S. State Department attorney, his quote. On rare occasion, this is leading up to his quote, there has been official acknowledgement of the deep-seated political motivations for understanding the potential health effects of low-level radiation. For example, William H. Taft, a U.S. State Department attorney, said in 1981, the mistaken impression that low-level radiation is hazardous has the potential to be seriously damaging to every aspect of the Department of Defense's nuclear weapons and nuclear propulsion programs. It could adversely affect our relations with our European allies.
All right, just hang on to that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment for our final segment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been Loren Murray. Do you have the website you gave earlier, of course, you talked about. Why don't you give this just one more time?
Okay. The website is www.mindfully, M-I-N-D-F-U-L-L-Y, www.freedomfighters.org. And we also have a website, www.radiation.org, which is studies around nuclear power plants.
All right, fine. What did you find when you checked around nuclear power plants?
Oh, very high levels of strontium-90, which is coming out of the nuclear power plants. In the baby teeth, it goes through the mother's body into the unborn baby.
Now, this was, how did it get out of the, because, of course, you just had the fuel rods. How did it get out of fuel rods into the environment?
Well, you know, those huge stacks that are always around nuclear power plants, the emissions that are coming out of them are very radioactive. And it's just slow fission. It's the slow release from the fuel rods of fission products, which are radioactive, instead of the rapid release from a nuclear weapon when it's detonated. It's the same stuff. And whether you're exposed internally to nuclear weapons or to nuclear power plant emissions or to depleted uranium, you're basically being exposed to alpha particles, beta particles, and gamma rays. So, never mind what it comes out of, they are all basically the same. They have different energies, but it's like putting a nuclear bomb in the cells in your body.
Well, now, of course, what about the danger to people working in the nuclear power plants? Aren't they fairly safe?
Oh, no, they're not safe, and they have a lot of radiation-related diseases. I just went to a meeting in Livermore with Livermore workers. Cancer, diabetes, obesity, neuromuscular and neurological diseases, all kinds of diseases from radiation exposure.
So
chronic fatigue syndrome.
What?
Chronic fatigue syndrome.
Okay.
It's damage to the mitochondria in the cell.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be having to wrap this program up. It's been a fascinating evening. I really want to thank you so very much for being with us. And just hang on there for just a moment, and then we'll say goodbye. Well, our guest this evening has been Wren Murray, and of course she is a whistleblower. She left the Livermore Laboratory to try to get information about the dangers of radiation. And of course, we're talking about depleted uranium this evening. I'd suggest that those websites, mindfully.org, that's mindfully.org, or www.radiation.org. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Yes, I'd just like to read a Gandhi quote.
Go ahead.
As human beings, our greatness lies not so much in being able to remake the world that is the myth of the atomic age, as in being able to remake ourselves. And Dr. Monteith, I'd like to thank you for remaking yourself, and I'd like to thank the audience for listening tonight.
Okay, fine. Will you hang on? I'm going to put you on hold, and then we'll get your address, and we'll send you that article about Jacques Cousteau.
Thank you.
Okay, hang on here. And this has been a fascinating hour. I hope you've enjoyed it. And, of course, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We hope, of course, you'll tell others about our programs. We hope you'll give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. HIV war, and of course that you will help us get the truth out across America about what's going on. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, why give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Our January newsletter goes into the background of the Illuminati. Did you know the Illuminati came to the United States? George Washington talked about the Illuminati or wrote a letter about the Illuminati. The president of both Harvard and Yale gave speeches warning about the danger of the Illuminati. The Clintonian Illuminati existed in New England in 1802. All of this is covered in our January newsletter. We'd be glad to send you a free copy if you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we ask you, let us know if you're listening on shortwave. We want to be sure we're reaching enough people by shortwave. It's going to take a little while to build up our listening audience. And, of course, people can listen on the Internet or they can listen on shortwave. But please talk to your friends if they don't have a computer. Urge them to get a shortwave, or they can contact us if they need more information on shortwave. And then start listening on a regular evening basis as we cover the various subjects that they need to understand, that they need to be able to verbalize and explain to others about what's going on today. The big problem in the United States is the other side controls the media. Well, right now, through Internet, where 4 hours a day our programs can be heard, shortwave, where 4 hours every day our programs can be heard, 5 hours on the Internet, 4 hours on shortwave, and then as we begin expanding our radio audience, in other words, radio stations that are pulling us down, it's exciting to know that we're going to be reaching people, but quite frankly, we need your help. It's expensive to buy radio time, but this is the only way we're going to be able to reach a sufficient audience in sufficient time, if there's any hope at all of preserving this nation, which has given us so much in the past, and yet which the enemies of freedom are intent upon destroying through globalization, through transferring our jobs and our industries overseas, by destroying the value of our currency, by destroying the moral foundation of this once great and noble Christian nation, and then undermining the very foundations of our liberty. Well, until tomorrow, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because I'm firmly convinced if the American people do not return to the faith of our founding fathers, why, America will cease to exist as a free and independent nation. We ask you, of course, to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but we ask you to remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927 or 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Until tomorrow evening, when we'll be with you once again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.